Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, MP Naz Shah, Tasneem Chopra and Mikhzad Versailles examine how Islamophobia is being mobilised today in the UK and across the globe. Who gains from it and how it is being challenged? What does it take to confront it at its roots, not just in rhetoric, but in power structures? Recorded live at the 2025 festival and chaired by Saeed Khan, our panel asks whether Islamophobia is shaping the policies that divide us. And what do we do if we don't confront it?
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Bradford Literature Festival, and welcome to this session on Islamophobia Now, Power, Prejudice, and Resistance. My name is Professor Saeed Khan, coming to you from Detroit and Wayne State University. For those of you who've been here for the duration of the festival, you will notice that it is probably 10 degrees cooler today in this room than it was last Saturday. So hopefully we'll provide you with a little bit more comfort in our discussion of certainly a very serious topic and one which we probably hoped we wouldn't have to keep having sessions on. But nonetheless, Islamophobia is not only present, but it seems as though it is mutating and becoming more severe and more pervasive. Our discussion today is with three real experts on this who bring a variety of different dimensions to the discussion: politics, media, culture, and also the corporate world. Looking at these matters both in professional as well as their personal dimensions, which I think sometimes are forgotten in such conversations, that Islamophobia, like many other forms of bigotry, do affect lives beyond just the statistics. So starting from the far left of mine, and probably someone who has traversed the greatest distance to be at the festival, we have Tasneem Chopra, a cross-cultural consultant, a celebrated keynote speaker, a writer, and a champion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which probably, unfortunately, jeopardizes her ability to get a visa to the United States now because DEI is an endangered species there. She holds a bachelor's in psychology and sociology from Swinburne University, a master's in international development from La Trobe University, is an adjunct fellow at Victoria University. She's been appointed inaugural ambassador for Women of Color Australia, and in 2020, she was awarded the Order of Australia Medal for services to community, diversity, and leadership. Next to her in the middle is Mikhzad Versailles, who holds a degree in mathematics from the University of Oxford. He's the Assistant General Secretary for the Muslim Council of Britain and a member of the Muslim Leadership Group for Citizens Commission on Islam. Mikhzad leads much of the MCB's work on counterterrorism. And as many of you probably know, he has extensive media experience with both broadcast and print media, including in such outlets as Newsnight, The Times, Al Jazeera English, as well as several others, and is a regular contributor to The Guardian's online section of Comment is Free. Coming distance-wise now to somewhere a little bit more proximate to Bradford, we, of course, have Naz Shah, who is a British Labour Party politician, elected in 2015 in the general election as an MP from Bradford West, winning the seat from George Galloway, who was then a member of the Respect Party. Currently, Naz is appointed as the UK's trade envoy to Indonesia and the ASEAN region, something for which she was appointed in January 2025. Welcome all. I'd like to go ahead and do a temperature test from all of you. On a scale of 1 to 5, Islamophobia being an existential threat to the Muslim community, 1 being that it is something rather mild, where would you put Islamophobia today, Tasneem?
Globally, I'd put it at 4.5.
Wow, okay. Now we're off to an optimistic turn here. There's still that 0.5 remaining. Right, Mikhzad.
I'd put it 3.5, if we're going to do 0.5s. 3.5.
Okay.
Being the centrist, right, I'm going to go for about 4. Yeah, definitely about 4.
Well, I must admit, those are slightly higher and a bit more pessimistic numbers than I had anticipated. Anything above a 3 seems to be very severe. So, Tasneem, you're based in Australia, and does distance insulate the community there from the global trends that you're saying is at about a 4.5, or is it more concentrated there?
Distance is there, yes, but I think proximity to trauma is not an issue, because we are living in a world where a genocide is being televised. People are seeing that. It is impacting people's lived day-to-day experiences of how they turn up and show up at work and community, at school, however, whatever that looks like. The implications of that and the reactions to that have been policed, have been scrutinized, have been weaponized. So to the extent that, yeah, Australia is far from the region where the conflict is occurring, the impacts are still very much felt on the ground.
Okay. McDonald, how do you see the landscape? I mean, here you are particularly within the realm of media. And so your appearances then serve to, in some ways, clarify and provide a corrective. But it also seems as though you're having to do a lot of fighting against a narrative that has not only formed, but in many ways, arguably facilitates and drives Islamophobia.
Yeah, very, very much so. I'd say in the UK, the media landscape plays a really vital, problematic role in driving Islamophobia in the UK. It shapes the narratives. It's not necessarily the only mechanism through which that narrative can come. Social media, a political leadership also plays an important role. But the way that the media sort of represents Muslims in the public space is astonishing. If you look at probably the biggest 2 or 3 trends in the UK, you've got of where Muslims are seen on the screen. One is on Gaza, one is on grooming, and one is on other stuff. Let's call it whatever. But if you look at those two, grooming gangs and Gaza, Muslims are treated ridiculously. And it's not necessarily using the word Muslim, but it's the inherent Islamophobia associated with it. If you, we did a study on the BBC, which is the best out of all of the news outlets, it's perceived to be one of the best out there. And the way it treats Palestinian lives versus Israeli lives is night and day. The way that it humanizes Israeli lives versus the way it doesn't for Palestinian lives is night and day. And so you see the value of life being considered to be different. And then on the grooming gangs, the reason I mentioned that is that one of the worst things you can possibly do is sexually exploit a child, right? Or the worst visceral thing. You want to protect your family, but Muslims are perceived as are being created and shaped as the antagonist there, as the ones who are raping our young children, our white young children, our white young girls. That's the most visceral reaction. And that leads to a real danger in terms of this perception of Muslims and others. The stats aside, they don't matter. Reality, facts don't matter. The fact that 40,000, 50,000, 60,000 Palestinians have been killed versus 1,000 Israelis, the stats don't matter. So where's the value? Where are the problems? Where are the solutions? And we are the problem. And what's really interesting for me is that whilst that is the perception in the media and the way that the media talks about it, on an underlying basis, Muslim communities are actually becoming so much more integrated, so much better educated, so much, every stat is starting to get better from an underlying perspective. So the arc of history long term is fine, but it's this real dangerous situation right now, this precipice we're on right now, where this narrative about Muslims is so problematic that it can tip over in a very dangerous direction, as we're seeing with some of the polling and the narratives that are being created about Muslims.
So in America, we have this phenomenon of the T word being used to describe Muslims. And Muslims will sit there and literally, if there's an incident happening, pray, even the less pietistic, that it's not, quote unquote, one of us. And if the word terrorist is not used, there's almost like a collective exhale that if it's not a terrorist, it means it's not a Muslim actor. But in the case of, in the British context, coming from the US and taking a look at this, names like Jimmy Savile, names like Gary Glitter, names like, well, I'll put that in there as well, Prince Andrew. I mean, we're looking at whether they are allegations of, or certainly accounts of stories dealing with sexual abuse, don't involve Muslim actors. But why do you think there's this essentialization that, as you said, grooming equals or is synonymous with a community.
So the way that this is unfortunately being framed is by people who have an agenda at play. If you look at child sexual exploitation, objectively, across any type of child sexual exploitation, individual, group, whatever, then Muslim communities are not overrepresented in the instigators.
Can I just add to that? I mean, I read just the other day that the Muslim threat narrative, it's not a glitch, it's the program, right? So by design, those incidences will be sought out to profile and to amplify evil, even in the face of alternative information showing the opposite. In like you say, the education, the contribution, the political participation, it's all there. But we overshadow that. We amplify the one because the other 99, which would redeem us, are not given a platform.
That's spot on. And that's why, you know, I was about to just talk about the stats, but, you know, stats almost don't matter. It just seems exactly right there. You know, Muslims are not overrepresented in child exploitation generally. In group-based child sexual exploitation, Muslims aren't massively overrepresented based on the data we have. In one, because there's family, there's institutional, church-based, family-based, none of which are Muslims are overrepresented. When it comes to street-based child sexual exploitation, based on the data that we have, which is about 30% of the data out there, Muslims are probably overrepresented there in that one element. But that's one element out of all, and it's still bad. It needs to be dealt with. But that's the point. You can find the stat, as Destiny was saying, you can find a stat, you can flip it, you can create a narrative around it, rather than actually saying what's actually happening in society. And rather than dealing with problems, framing it as a Muslim problem, framing it as a Pakistani problem, framing these types of things in a racist way, it has the potential to cause problems. I don't mean necessarily a racist way in the sense that it's necessarily racism to talk about this stuff. It isn't. You can talk about this stuff fairly. Talk about child sexual exploitation done by Pakistanis if you want. There's no problem with that. But do that in the right context. If that's the only thing that's driving you, then you're going to have problems. Like right now, there's someone talking about, there's an MP in Parliament who wants to talk about halal food as a problem. Now, it's totally fair if someone has a specific view on animal welfare. And they're talking about animal welfare, that's the only thing they talk about. Fine, they can talk about that, right? But if they talk about that and they want to only talk about Muslim religious slaughter, but not Jewish religious slaughter, there's a question, why? Why are you choosing one over the other? Why do you want to be a big thing? Why? Because it helps the narrative about Muslims. It's all of these things together, grooming, halal food, terrorism. In the UK, in the last decade, the number of people who've been killed due to terrorism related to Muslims is very minor. If you look at the last 50 years, actually probably more have been killed due to Northern Ireland related terrorism than actually Islamist related terrorism. So the stats, that the data doesn't support this type of narrative, but what's happening is that certain groups, certain politicians, because they want to win elections, certain think tanks, because they want to push a certain agenda, certain groups who hate Muslims are pushing this. Media outlets are facilitating it. And you have a situation where the perception of Muslims and the reality of Muslims are fundamentally different.
And we saw this just recently with the observance or the commemoration of the 20th anniversary of 7/7. I'm not sure if there is an analogous situation to any of the IRA bombings, which were quite severe. Naz, there's a relationship between the media and politics. Do you find that it's the media that's amplifying these politicians that Miqdad is speaking about? Or is it the politicians that are amplifying the media? I mean, what's that relationship like here?
Toxic is one way of putting it. So the relationship between the media, so I'll give you an example, and this is my personal example. So when I won Leave EU, a libel case for being called a grooming gang's apologist, so when I tweeted something, which was a genuine tweet that was up for 8 minutes, it was a retweet, a like, and I took it down immediately because on its own, in the context, it wasn't seen as what it was, which was, it was a sarcastic Owen Jordan's parody account. And I retweeted it. I shouldn't have done, because the minute you take a screenshot, it becomes something else. And you don't realize that at the time. So the newspaper covered it at the time. We had a long conversation about this. And this was in just after the Newcastle grooming scandal back in 2017. I've had death threats for that tweet. People have gone to prison for that tweet. We're talking eight years ago now, right? And it still comes back to haunt me. I'm still getting libeled on it. But not one of those news outlets covered my libel win against about that tweet. The High Court in this country said, because we had to provide evidence of all the work that I've done for victims of grooming, and Levy, you had to put a statement out that we accept Naz Shah is a vociferous campaigner for victims of grooming. But not one of those outlets carried that story. That's the difference. It is the Times. We remember when I was on the Home Affairs Select Committee, Miqdad and I did a lot of work on this when we had the Times in front of us. Do you remember the Muslim foster child story? When we had the hijab, the jihadi story from The Sun, which had 3,000 odd complaints, unprecedented amount. Then we had, it's just like Miqdad was known in the time and he still carries that trophy of, you know, being the person who corrects every newspaper. But if you've got a front page headline, your correction is a tiny little thing right in buried deep inside the paper that nobody really has to see. If you look at Sky News, October the 7th happened. October the 7th happened, we had the Palestinian ambassador. So I'm part of the Executive Labour Friends of Palestine. Hussam was supposed to attend an event that evening. It was the first one we were doing since Keir coming effectively. We were kind of reviving Labour Friends of Palestine. Saturday happened. On Tuesday, the Sky News reporter went to say, I think it was James Cleverly, that the Palestinian ambassador has said Israel had it coming. He didn't say that. He did not say that. Right. But he went back to London and that evening and the amount of cancel culture of a guy who just lost his family as well. He'd lost people from his side. We, you know, the trauma that he was going through and the Israelis had gone through just 3 days prior, what was happening. It was the that got repeated so many times, and it wasn't until there was lots and lots of emails and etc. But it's relentless, Saeed. It's like how much energy can you put into this? How much energy did it take for us in those days to get those corrections out? And it does help because they now at least they know versus looking at us. We've got to be careful which the headline we do. So it has stemmed it, but they just get a bit more creative. They just get a bit more creative of packaging it out, of saying things. And Robert Jenrick, it's like the idea that Muslims don't condemn grooming. That is absolute BS because it is the worst thing. It's like we've been otherized that we're less British because these kids who have been abused, we forget to tell the narrative that actually it was a Pakistani Muslim that believed these girls in the first instance. It was him who led that prosecution. We don't tell that story because it doesn't suit the narrative of the right wing. It doesn't suit the narrative of otherizing British Muslims. It doesn't suit the narrative of, it doesn't allow us to be, it's kind of like, you know, I talked about it on the, if you look at the, you know, the famous poem by the pastor who said, you know, they came for him. I wasn't one of them, and I didn't speak up.
Rabbi Hirschman.
You know that poem. I read that out in Parliament because that's exactly how I feel as a Muslim parliamentarian. The level of abuse that we get. Anybody who puts their head above a parapet. Mandani, you know, in the US this morning, I watched one of his interviews, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think, said, "Oh, he was celebrating when 9/11 happened. The kid was 9 years old. He was 9 years old. He might have been, I'd be interested in how many nine-year-olds are really, really that politically aware that they're going to be celebrating flipping 9/11, the biggest terrorist attack. Do you know, it's like we're held up. There's a different measuring yardstick if you're a person of colour. There's an even different measuring yardstick if you happen to be a different gender. But God, if you're a Muslim, that yardstick goes out the window."
And as you mentioned that this is coming from the right, Tasneem, there's been, I think it's fair to say, Islamophobia from the left. And you mentioned Zohran Mamdani, who is the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. And the New York Times, which has never been accused of being a Murdoch publication or anything like the Daily Mail, the newspaper of record, and one that is seen as at least on its op-ed pages leaning center-left, really came after Mamdani 2 days ago, running a hit piece by someone else, but still giving it space, claiming that when he was applying for admission to Columbia University, he put himself down as African American as a way to delegitimize him and to, in many ways, also make the argument that the Trump administration is finding reason to denaturalize him for making some kind of misrepresentation. Speak to me about how the left also deploys Islamophobia and your experience.
I think it has, again, and I would have to go back to the issue of Gaza again, and how that has been an interesting platform where we've seen the left vehemently support Ukraine and Ukrainians and the resettlement and supporting them and giving them refugee status and taking care of them and having no qualms with our governments providing that level of support and allyship and being contrary to Russia as an example. But when it's come to Palestine, and I would argue that some in the left movement have been definitely silent to the extent that that particular issue is too complicated. They want to understand, they want to, you know, they're sorry things are going wrong, but when it comes to advocating, lobbying, actually doing the hard work to shift political, to force company or policy or political policy to actually take a stand, it's constantly been of, you know, we need to work with everyone on, we need to look at both sides. It's both siding the genocide that has been the problem for me with the left. I think to that end, in Australia at least, I can say that to some extent. And I feel it's the consequences of that have been an undermining of quite a lot of loss from their base, I would say, when it comes to elections. Having said that, the current incumbent government in Australia was returned, though not without realisation that even to this day, there is a strong level of accountability that they fail to meet on this particular issue. So, yeah, I think it's been really disappointing to see the influence of lobby groups impact the left movement in a way that has never historically been an issue.
Migdad, same question. I mean, you deal with an entire spectrum of editorial ideology, whether it's in broadcast or in print. Can you really distinguish the difference now when it comes to Islamophobia? Is it a matter of just how it's deployed, or is it something that is even distinguishable when it comes to its substance?
When it comes to right and left, it is. Like, the right is worse. The right wing, the visceral nature of the Islamophobia, the otherization, the fact that these guys are less they are, it comes through quite perniciously in everything, right? On the hard right, and even center right to some extent, it is really, really problematic. But what I think, what I worry about on the left side, where as Tasneem said, I think when it comes to Gaza, the failures are all across the board. But what's interesting on the left, including on the politician side, with some exceptions, of course, is that Muslims are dispensable. That's my word for them. It's not that, so I'd say that a lot of the left in the political landscape do care. They actually think about Islamophobia as a real thing. It matters. It's something important. But when push comes to shove, we don't matter. When push comes to shove, I don't care about these types of things. I want to do the minimum that's required to make this issue go away. The right will push hard on it, so I'll let it go. But there are certain things I won't let go, but this I will. And the problem that leads to is that who then stands up for equality and fairness? And yeah, it just doesn't come. And there are some, of course, on the right who are also very good. I mean, I don't want to just make it unfair. There are people on the right who are good, but a lot on the right are really negative, and on the left, we're dispensable. And when it comes to the media landscape, the muscular liberal ideology, which probably was stronger about a decade ago, now seems to have calmed down a little bit, and actually a lot more of the op-eds are thoughtful about this topic in a better way. But on Gaza, everything goes to pot. We don't matter at all.
Now, as Migdad used the word dispensable, are Muslims politically dispensable, or is it more of a matter that they are commodifiable, that they're useful when it comes to votes, and then the day after the election, it goes back? Because that seems to be the phenomenon in America, that everybody came to Dearborn in Michigan to court the Muslim vote, and in some cases it shifted it. in November. Is that something that you're finding here?
So here's the thing. When you talk about Islamophobia on the left and you try to raise these things, I still walk into conversations which are really, really uncomfortable. It's like you're being told in not so many words, but from the body language, will you shut up about this? Stop talking about this. There is that. There is still circles in Parliament, in politics, that really, really want you to not talk about it. That is without saying. But you've got to be in it to change it, right? Then there's another conversation, which is, well, we don't want to get into the culture war space because the Tories and the right wing want us to keep in the culture war space. The question is, then how do the left, and they haven't figured this out, and they don't do it, they don't have the answer to this, is how does the left then hold on to its conviction? And you and I, we were all there at the dinner opening of a literature festival, and Ben Okri was saying, you've got to lead with light. Right now, we don't have that leading with light when it comes to Muslims. There's that hypocrisy of the way Muslims are talked about. And then there's another conversation, which we don't like to have, which is, and the Labour Party, you know, we lost seats. The Labour Party lost seats where on the issue of Gaza. You know, what used to be a stronghold for us, we have lost that. So we have to learn lessons from that. We have to engage with the Muslim community. But there's also a narrative from, if you speak to people like Muslim Vote and others, that actually, yes, they had a few wins, but by and large, they also, and this is a conversation people have, is they've made the Muslim irrelevant. Because when you have a party which wins such a big majority without the Muslim vote, then why should Muslims matter? Do you see where I'm coming from? So that's also a conversation that happens on the left side of politics. And what it needs is engagement. So every time we have engagement, so you have that we need to do more. Let's be really clear. The government must do more. And I'm part of those conversations. Has it done enough? I don't feel it has. But the one thing is, at least we're having the conversation, which we didn't have for 9 years when I was in opposition with the Tory government. The Tory government, if you look at Badenoch, she didn't even, for the first time, she didn't wish anybody Ramadan Kareem or Eid Mubarak, etc. So we have got a working group. But then you've got people like Nick Timothy, who are tweeting out, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about the Islamophobia definition. Now I can see one of the academics here who helped us with the Islamophobia definition. You know, it's like we want to do this, but the bare minimum, I think some of that does apply because we have got a working group, but that working group is because of years of pressure when the Islamophobia definition was developed by the All Party Parliamentary Group, which was in 2017. And it's like Muslims don't have the agency. Why should we give you Muslims agency? We don't have the same question when it comes to the definition of anti-Semitism. You know, rightfully, you cannot have anything about Jews without Jews in the room. You can't have anything about Muslims without Muslims in the room, right? But it's no. And then there's this hierarchy issue because when you talk to the community, it's like, well, it's okay. You've got a definition of anti-Semitism that gets support and you don't get the definitions, the support, which has been largely consulted on. We did that piece of work, took us years to get off the ground, Miqdad, and we were all involved in that. But it is that, where, how do we get a definition of Islamophobia? And we're stuck on this we're stuck on the word Islamophobia. And that in itself is problematic because actually, I'm not fussed about the word. I just want to recognise somebody to say to me that this crap, I was going to say something really bad then, but this is real and it affects people's lives. I am petrified at times for my daughter who's a hijab wearer and a visible Muslim. You know, we were in America in November and she was getting another flight. We were just 5 minutes apart landing in the same place at Concordia. And she said, I'm nervous. And I looked at her and I went, you've travelled all over. You've been to Australia, you've been everywhere on your own. You've never been nervous. She went, and I wasn't wearing a hijab then. I swear to God, that hit me like a ton of bricks. It's like my child saying to me, I am nervous because I wasn't wearing a hijab. That's close to home. That is really close to home. So I think for me, I think the left have to do more. We can't say it's a culture war, so we don't want to get into it. That's not good enough. We can't say the Muslims are irrelevant because we've just had, you know, we've won the election without them. That's not good enough. We have to do more. And again, people like us keep holding their feet to the fire, don't we? But yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that earlier comment you made there, Naz, about, again, how the left has got this wrong. I can recall a time, certainly within Australian context, as specifically where when the opportunity came to onboard members of parliament from Muslim backgrounds, they were the first to clap their hands, welcome them, parade them around, take them around the world to say, look how diverse and inclusive our political portfolio is. Look at us. Aren't we wonderful? But when the same young MP of Afghani background decided to vote against her party on a motion to criticize Israel, she was censured. She was eventually sidelined. Then she left the party and she became an independent. The same MP. So your values and your culture and your shiny, sparkly attraction are all great until your values don't, your values are going to conflict with our party lines. So that to me was a classic example of tokenism done really badly. But it also showed how duplicitous that kind of conniving performative inclusion is. And we see governments do that with minority communities, like we're great for parties and samosas and falafels, but just don't come to us when you're upset with our political policy and our foreign policy. Because stay in your cultural lane and let us do the work. It's almost as if the Muslim community has been regarded as incapable of having political agency, even when we have political people in government. It's a dehumanization to a large extent, I think. And the word dehumanization and Muslim entity, I think, has been bandied around now for 18 to 20, 25 months with much greater rigor than I've ever seen before. Yeah.
So Tasneem, just to unpack that, I mean, you're working in the space of the culture wars. I mean, arguably even in the trenches of this, and you go into spaces like corporations and all with your work on DEI. Where then is Islamophobia within DEI? Is it the great trench line beyond which you can be diverse about everything, but not about Muslims?
It's embedded in anti-racism. So whether it's Islamophobia or, anti-Semitism or anti-blackness or anti-Arabness, it's one of many, and it does require the same level of resourcing and attention. However, I would argue strongly that the implications for seeing justice served to an act of Islamophobia in the workplace in most of the global West is so much harder. The bar that you need to reach to actually demonstrate what has happened is very, very high. Inversely, some comments which are not anti-Semitic but are deemed such, the threshold is far lower and the consequences are much higher.
So on that, Mikdad, I mean, you spend enough time probably having to work with the semantics within journalism and all. The idea, as Tasneem said, that not just what might be Islamophobic or not, what might be anti-Semitic or not, but who gets to decide. And it seems as though there's a lot of, for lack of better terms, Islam-splaining. You don't get to decide when you say globalize the Intifada what it means. We get to decide for you what that means. And you saw this, of course, as one of the ways that there is the disparagement of, again, Mamdani in New York. How does that play out in journalism, and how effective is the pushback on trying to reclaim agency for what you're saying and what you mean? Otherwise, it seems as though they're doing a really good job of reading your mind.
I think it's a fantastic point. If you look across the media landscape today, when one individual in the public space will say something like death to the IDF, we will have front page stories. We will have a change in the way that the government engages with media. Lisa Nandy, who's in charge of this area, she's not supposed to be pressuring the BBC. In fact, on the back of the report that we put together, there was a question given to the government saying, what are you going to do about this report that highlights the Islamophobia within the BBC and the way that they're reporting about Gaza? And the government response was, we don't get involved in this stuff. We don't pressure the BBC. They're independent. We don't. Really, it's really important. It was a public statement given by the government on this issue. Literally the same day, Lisa Nandy is writing in the Times saying, we've been speaking to the BBC, trying to get them to sack these people. And what the hell? It is as clear. It is so clear. But what I find fascinating is that even when it is that clear, they can get away with it. It doesn't, in America, was it yesterday, day before yesterday, the president of the United States uses anti-Semitic language. Shylock, we're talking about bankers. This is anti-Semitic. There's no ifs and buts about this. There's no way to pretend it's not anti-Semitic. It's explicitly anti-Semitic. But do you see Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, going out there and on the radio shows talking about how this is anti-Semitism? No, because it's a person of power who that person wants to be close to. Principles don't matter in this. And this is what I think I've been very naive in the past. I've been of the view integrity matters. Principles matter. Anti-racism matters. None of that matters. Power is what matters. And the problem is, as you rightly say, it is those with power who get to decide what is acceptable. There are half the MPs in Parliament have tweeted and retweeted things far worse in every single way than the 8-minute thing that Naz did. A member of Parliament in my area retweeted Tommy Robinson, one of the most vile anti-Muslim bigots in this country. Is that fine? No, the Prime Minister of the time came to their constituency. No problem whatsoever. Because we don't matter. Because power is what matters. And this is something that I'm being a little bit simplistic in that. Of course, anti-racism matters. Of course, principles matter. And we should always stand by and speak on behalf of those who are disenfranchised and speak to power and hold people accountable. But we also have to recognize that reality, that power is what matters.
Just a moment of context for anyone. The chant of death to the IDF was made by the artist Bob Villan. That's V-Y-L-A-N, not D-Y-L-A-N. At Glastonbury recently, which has led to not only all of this backlash, but apparently also the cancellation of his recent U.S. and European tour. Also, you probably heard at Glastonbury, there was a lot of uproar of the Irish band Kneecap that was also part of this. But there was also, in the case of what you were saying regarding Trump's invocation of Shakespeare, which I'm not sure if he read Merchant of Venice or if it was read to him, but John Podhoretz, the commentator and erstwhile journalist, he tweeted and he said that as long as Trump bombs Iran, he can call me Shylock 100 times over. So I think when it comes to this negotiation of power, similar with Greenblatt at the ADL, I think these are examples that affirm what you're saying. Naz, okay, you have someone like, and I use this word in its very loose way, a colleague in Parliament, like Lisa Nandi, who is doing this kind of advocacy work, it seems. Where's the counter in that in Parliament?
So I think for me, the counter is by being there. So it's interesting. So you've got the independents on the opposite side who challenge, but you've also got our side who challenge. And Lisa Nandi used to be the chair of Labour Friends of Palestine. So she's a huge friend to the issue of Palestine and the cause of Palestine. What I feel happens with politicians of all ilks, not just my party, but the opposite party, because you've got louder voices, fringe voices, the reason why the fringe expands, even though it's only tiny, they bang the drum louder. They bang it much louder because their whole lives and energy is going into banging that drum. And others have a day job. So when we have day jobs and we have to run the country or be in opposition, whichever way it is, we aren't just fixated on just promoting Islamophobia because that's what gets us the kind of narratives. It's like the Reform MP, her first question as a Prime Minister's question was about the niqab. She hadn't even got people. She's got less than a few hundred Muslim women who could potentially wear the hijab in the niqab in her constituency. So that's one thing. So you've got to balance it out with that. And then in Parliament, we have a group of us through Labour Friends of Palestine, we've got to help the party get to where we need to get it to. So it's like when I resigned on the ceasefire vote in November, it wasn't where it needed to be in November 2023, but it got there by February 2024. And even if you look at 2 weeks ago, Vicky Foxtrot resigned on the issue of a welfare bill. But by the time we got it to the actual vote this week, Vicky Foxtrot actually voted for the bill because the government gave concessions. So politics is very, very, but Twitter doesn't give us that time to explain all of these things about how these conversations work, how much pressure goes on in the background. So we continue to pressure. If anybody knows me, they'll know that I'm not shrinking violet in terms of issue on Palestine, in terms of issue on welfare, etc. But it's about, so that's where there is a voice, there is an alternative voice. I mean, now if you listen to, you know, we've got a hard left breaker with Zara announcing that she's launching a political party. So there is even more hard left voices that are being clear about what their left voices are. So there's not, Parliament isn't without scrutiny. The only thing is we're not the fringe that are banging that drum, because we want to work with the government, because ideally I want my government to be in the right space. And at times we disagree, which is why I did not vote for the welfare bill last week. And I'm waiting for this week to see what the next for the third reading. But that doesn't always come out. It comes out like, well, nobody's challenging. But actually, I can promise you, there are people who challenge. There is no way the government would have literally given the 11th hour concessions had it not been for reasoned amendments in Parliament last week. So there are things that be achieved, but not everything makes a press because they're closed door conversations. You know how politics works.
Not as well as you. Well, at least I hope not. Tasneem, so when you're working in the space of DEI, I mean, literally embedded in the acronym is inclusion. And this suggests that marginalized groups should come together, form coalitions, be allies, be friends, be advocates for one another. Are there limits to or opportunity costs to that happening regarding combating Islamophobia? What have you found when it comes to the reliance on the sense of making alliances and coalitions?
I think trauma is quite a unifying factor. I think the incident of when Fatima Payman, the senator in question, who I mentioned before, who was censured from her party, then forced to resign, then went independent. When that happened, Muslims across the country unified in a sense, across even sectarian lines. There was a sense that how could this happen in a democracy to an Australian Muslim woman, to an Australian Muslim member of parliament? And the reaction to that was swift. It was united. You had entities, I think, that were more conservative and that were more liberal that did coalesce and that expressed their frustration to the extent then that prior to the last election, we had a first development of Muslim Votes Matters, which we have not had until that point. There was no unified entity, as there is in the US with MGAGE and in the UK as well. That particular entity was really interesting. It was national. It comprised Australian Muslims of a multitude of ethnic backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, but with a shared ambition of having a united voice to present to government that as a bloc, our opinions matter, our issues matter. So I would say, if you'd asked me 10, 15 years ago that same question, I would have thought, oh, there's a lot of disparity. We really can't unify. Things are very divided. And I'm not saying it's our North Star now, but it is a heck of a lot better. And I am seeing that, again, unity based triggered from trauma. I think Gaza was the red line. And people came together because regardless of who you were, regardless of your ethnicity, your profession, or how much you made, you could not help but feel changed by what you saw. And we need to do something because our government is not doing something. But we need to be smart about it. Pointlessly protesting, pointlessly, you know, throwing our arms up in the air or burying our head in the sand is getting us nowhere. We need to be collectivist about this. So we utilised the smarts we had with strategy, with engagement, with marketing, and put it all together. And we were able to put up, it wasn't about putting up candidates, it was about advising on who would be the most appropriate person to vote come election time by doing the hard work. So that election has come and gone. The entity is still there. Gaza is still burning. But I think communities, I think even issues like the weekly protest marches that are happening in Melbourne, and I don't know if they're still happening weekly in London.
Weekly.
Not weekly?
Not weekly.
Okay, well, they're still happening weekly in Australia. Those are sites of collection. And again, you're seeing Australian Muslims from across your city coming together. And it's not just Muslims. Muslims probably make up less than 50% of that. And that is powerful because that is also then showing that we are part of the whole. So I think there's something to be said for collective action done in the spirit of coming off the back of a traumatic event, but also recognizing that alone we can do nothing, but united we can actually begin to make a change.
You know, what's really interesting, Tasneem, is that in the American context, and Nabil, I think you probably saw this, in 2017, there was a spirit of inclusiveness when it came to protesting the Muslim travel ban. and you saw many from the left and center left coming on board. But there was an erosion of that over the last 8 years because there didn't seem to be a reciprocity when it came to Muslims supporting issues like LGBTQ. And there has been a severe decline now in the kind of inclusiveness when it comes to quote-unquote Muslim issues. I mean, there's a new travel ban, for example. And so it seems as though the civic level of engagement still is imbalanced. Are you finding that to be the case in Australia?
Well, to the extent that the LGBTQI movement have been pretty strong in front center on the Gaza moment, I would say it's not been to the detriment of civic engagement and relations. I think those who have an agenda have tried to pinkwash this argument and say that, you know, clearly Gaza is not in the interests of our LGBT community. And they're like, you know, just do not speak for us. And I said, they've been a tremendous ally. I think it needs to be said. And those who are genuinely about the issue will say that. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the obnoxious talking points is that, well, you know, you don't want to be gay in Gaza because they're going to fling you off a tall building. It's like, well, there are no tall buildings left in Gaza. So, I mean, it just becomes a rather stupid engagement.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, the bottom line here is humanity. It's life, it's children, it's the fundamental respect for that. I think those who are trying to wedge, politicize this issue, they have not been interested in the humanity of Palestinians, so that's irrelevant.
Okay. Mikdad, you see particularly with President Trump, him seemingly championing the Jewish community in the interest of combating anti-Semitism. So going after Harvard University, the oldest university in the United States, still 600 years younger than Oxford, bombing Iran as a way to combat anti-Semitism, defending Bibi Netanyahu to stay in power and away from his criminal trial because this is needed. Is that a helpful strategy to have somebody outside be the champion to combat anti-Semitism from a Muslim standpoint or for the Muslim community standpoint? Let's say for the sake of hypothetical that someone was championing combating Islamophobia by doing such actions. What's the opportunity cost on that? Do you think that that is something that would be appealing to Muslims, or is the price going to be too high to pay?
I'm sure there'll be some people who like this stuff, but I think you should never give away your humanity. You should never give away your principles on these types of things. I mean, we lose long term if we ally ourselves with the far right, with those who are doing things that are problematic. I don't think that should ever be our strategic or even tactical solution. Of course, you can. There'll be times when, you know, you'll vote in a similar way. That's what it is. But strategic alliances with people who are fundamentally problematic or doing really problematic things is not the right solution. And one thing I would note on a lot of these issues, and including on Gaza, is whilst the elite seem to have just not care about Palestinians in any meaningful way, and again, that's slightly exaggerated for effect, the populace isn't like that. In the UK, and actually, of course, Pew polling globally, the support for Palestinians and the Palestinian cause is at record levels. In the UK, 60 to 70%, I can't remember the exact number, are supportive of the Palestinian cause right now. And you think, and if you look at anyone under the age of 30, that number skyrockets. So long term, whilst tactically a lot is being lost, long term strategically, by standing on the right side of history, the long term is there. And so my worry isn't about the long term. I think long term, we as a community are doing much better. We as a community are being educated. We're working. We recognize our challenges and are tackling them. We've got a long way to go. Don't get me wrong, but in the short term, we have a real danger that people are going to, that something really quite dangerous might happen. We're on this precipice, in my view, where the value of Muslim lives is much less. The willingness to sort of discard concerns that Islamophobia could lead to something quite major has just seems to have gone away. What I find really difficult about this is only a year ago, there were riots on the street, for God's sake. In the UK, I was told, don't go out. I had my kids and I went home early from work. Why? Because I wanted to make sure my kids were safe. Because in my area, near my mosque, there was going to be a far-right protest. In the UK in 2026, what's going on? It was 2025 last year. We literally had a riot. People were trying to burn down a hotel where asylum seekers were sitting in there. And now we're having people trying to excuse those who are inciting that hatred on social media. They're trying to protect those people under the guise of free speech, whilst at the same time attacking everyone else on free speech. This stuff does not make logical sense. And so my worry is that we're in this place right now where things can go very dangerously. And there are those who are flirting with this, right? There are politicians on the left, on the so-called center left, who are flirting with this idea and using language like Island of Strangers in ways that they might apologize for later, but the damage is done. And they should just not, this is very dangerous. It might look appealing to attract certain center-right people to your side by talking bad about Muslims in an inverted way, about migrants, about those who are different. It may seem tactically astute to do that, or politically astute to do that. It is dangerous for the short and medium and longer term to try and go in this direction. And so my biggest plea to the leadership and to the government and to others is to not let that happen. The far right are on the rise. We're seeing the reform who will probably argue they're not far right. Maybe they are hard right, whatever you want to call them. They have the plurality of votes according to polling right now. Many within that party have hardcore Islamophobic views, not soft, not passable liberal Islamophobia, dinner table Islamophobia. I'm talking about visceral Islamophobia. I'm talking about mass deportation Islamophobia, ethnic cleansing Islamophobia, in their language that they're allowed to get away with. That is what is dangerous.
And I think that's because the violence perpetrated against Muslims and Islamophobia has been aligned with security. You know, this is how we keep our country safe. We demonize that group, we punish them, we imprison them, we cast these laws, because that's how we keep safe. That's how we make America great again. That's how we keep Britain safe. That's how we keep our borders safe. So the collation between safety and weapon and Islamophobia has now been distinct. That's why I said it's not a glitch. It's a program again. Yeah.
But again, that didn't happen in a vacuum. You've got from a UK perspective, from 7/7, you know, we're just marking the anniversary of that, and you've got prevent strategy and how that prevent strategy morphed into what it morphed into for Muslims. So it's like Brexit didn't happen overnight. You know, it was made over decades in terms of a narrative. Farage took eight attempts to get into Parliament. You know, it's his eighth attempt, you know. So what worries me is, where do we stop with Prevent has done that? It's like Prevent did serve the purpose of putting us on the back burner, if you like, and putting us and looking at us through that security lens. And now you've got another layer of that in terms of, so you had terrorism, extremism, and now it's migration, illegal asylum seekers, and you've got the grooming, and it all comes together and morphs together. And ultimately what it's doing is, and the politicians aren't responding how they should, is overrising and dehumanising Muslims who don't even visibly look like Muslims. And that's why the definition talks about Muslimness, because you can be attacked because you're perceived to be a Muslim, not because you are a Muslim. A guy who was attacked in America, he was attacked because he wore a turban. He was perceived to be a Muslim. So you could have somebody visiting a mosque and out of respect just decides to wear a headscarf, and that would be perceived to be a Muslim. I've yet to meet a bigot who stops you and says, well, actually, are you a Muslim before I can attack you, mate? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's that BS, isn't it? It's that. And again, it comes back to that agency of not being able to say, this is what we want as Muslims. This is our definition. This is how we see this manifesting out for us and the danger it poses for us. So it didn't happen in a vacuum, and it continues to morph into something which is very, very dangerous. I'm just going to finish on this point, Sage, was, you know, when Christchurch happened, Rotherham was on that gun. You know, everything that we've had in that grooming, we don't realise how serious it is. When we have mass murders, you know, this is for Rotherham. How many times have we had that now? And, yet in Rotherham, it was young people, the Muslims, who were the first to protest, who were the first to do all of that in Rotherham, and yet Rotherham is used time and time again. So it's scary. It is scary.
Yeah, the first casualty in the backlash after 9/11 was a Sikh American. He was good. Well, I think we have a little bit of time for some questions from you. So, okay, we got a question right back there, and there's a roving mic, and then we've got another question up here. And then, was that a question from you, sir?
Thank you very much. I'll try to be as articulate as I can, and you might call me a little bit kind of up in the clouds. I'm thinking how this aspect of integration and how we desperately need to bring communities together and listen to each other and do it out of respect. And I'm not sure I've got in my mind how that actually happens. The other thing is I just want to share a little bit about when I call it the workhouse, the warehouse, and they were talking about voting for reform. They know I don't like reform. And one of the lads said, nobody does anything for us white working class people. And I kind of wanted to jump in, but fortunately I had something else to do. And later on, I met this wise man and he says, you know, sometimes you're going to have to stop and think and ask that young man, because what he'll turn around and say is, it's nice for you, isn't it? You went to university for free. You had a nice middle class job for free. And now you come into the warehouse and pretend to be the big intellectual. And all I'm saying is, how do we open those paths so that I can listen to your story on the basis that you listen to my story, and we can maybe not share each other's experiences, but try to stop this horrible, dangerous fragmentation in Britain today? Thank you.
All right, thank you. Why don't we go ahead and take the other question as well, just in the interest of time, and then the third question, then the panelists can go ahead and address them as needed. Question here, and then question in the front row.
Yeah, thanks very much for this panel. My question really, you've mentioned quite a lot about Muslim agency in the owning of the understanding of Islamophobia. Why is it that there needs to be a group looking, a working group, looking at the definition of Islamophobia after the APG, who's chaired by somebody who was involved in the APG definition? And why does that need to be the case when you have the exclusion of Muslim representative organizations from and establishing other organizations which do basically the government's are very, very aligned to the government itself? What does that say about Islamophobia? Are we just going to keep talking about Islamophobia rather than actually doing anything about it?
Thank you. And lastly, the question in the front.
I'm going to ask a very difficult question. I'm a feminist, and it's a question that I have, and I'd like to invite anybody who can give me this answer, and I'm hoping that it follows on from the idea of integration. Now, I'm not a young person, and I've seen so many women now wearing the hijab and young women, and I don't understand why. I'm actually asking a very straightforward question, and I just think it feels like it's kind of patriarchal to see this. But I've never been able to ask anybody this, because it feels like I'm a bit afraid to ask that question. And I don't know whether that creates a barrier. I do feel it could feel a barrier for other people who aren't Muslim. Right. And I invite anybody who wears the hijab to tell me.
Why don't you go ahead and take and Tasneem, well, if you'd like to.
Anybody in the audience.
Because you wear a hijab, I'll let you take that one, but I am going to come in on this.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you for your question. Interesting form to ask the question, but I'm happy to answer the question. So as I see it, the wearing of the hijab is women who choose to wear the hijab do so as an act of faith and devotion to God. It's a choice that they make. You should not, and you cannot compel someone to wear it. By the same, but having said that, there might be instances where it does happen, when that does happen, it's not because of Islam, but I would argue in spite of it. Culturally, there's different manifestations of the hijab. There's more conservative styles, there might be more liberal styles, but ultimately the decision to wear the hijab is a woman's choice to make, because it's a relationship between her and her creator. Having said that, plenty of Muslim women don't wear hijab, but they still identify as Muslim because it is a personal choice, which is why when conversations are then had about Muslim women's dress, without the inclusion of Muslim women, or this decision that they, we need to liberate you from your hijab, so we're going to bomb your country so you can be free of your hijab, or we're going to forbid you from having to wear the hijab so that you be liberated and free, when it's my choice to wear it. In both those instances, the agency is lost. In none of those instances am I consulted, because it is a deeply, inherently spiritual connection and decision that I make with my creator. The same way a Christian might wear a crucifix, a Jewish person wear a yarmulke. It's their expression of identity with faith based on their terms. And it's a question that they should be able to answer. It's not an issue that men on boardroom tables should be debating or discussing. Muslim women's wardrobes should not be weaponized in order to serve political agendas, and they have been, because liberating women, and particularly Muslim women, has been the great go-to for many Western nations in the spirit of democracy.
Can I pick up on that one? First of all, can I just say thank you for your question? I'm really, really grateful for it. And the reason I'm grateful for it is because if we don't understand and we don't have them ask them questions, we're never going to understand. So I, for one, appreciate it. So my daughter decided to wear the hijab. And more women are finding that they're wearing the hijab, because when I was raised in Bradford, right here in Bradford, I had a cultural understanding of Islam. I didn't have the understanding of Islam. And actually, the more I understand about this Islam, so I've you know, marched on these streets. I've my first award for women's rights was back in the 1990s. I've campaigned in Bradford. I've campaigned against patriarchy. But one thing I've realized as a woman who's lived through abusive experiences is, had men around my mother or me had more Islam in them, I'd have been more safer. And I'd have felt much safer. And that's the exact thing that I pass on to my children, both my boys and my daughter. It does let's not conflate patriarchy with Islamic teachings, because every religion will be taken by some on the fringes and suiting their narrative. For me, as a common sense perspective, I'm not a theologian, I'm not an academic in the subject, my relationship is between me and God. In every sense of the way. So I don't wear the hijab. Maybe that's my test, as I see it from an Islamic perspective, but my daughter does. And I will absolutely support her right to choose to wear what she wants. And more girls, the more Islamophobia we have, that's the patriarchy of it. The patriarchy is absolutely morphed inside that Islamophobia, because what it's saying is, all of a sudden, every right-wing guy becomes a feminist for Muslim women what to wear, because we choose to wear a burkini or we choose to wear this. And it's like, I would encourage you to sit with lots of women, young people who wear the hijab, and honestly, you will be enlightened about how much freedom it gives them. The Quran became my feminist handbook, I can promise you. The stories, patriarchy tells us that Islam is oppressive. Patriarchy tells us it defines us in a different way or wants us. Islam hasn't done that for me, and I'm a women's rights advocate and I'm a feminist, you know, and Islam gives me that. But I will come back to the other question. You were part of those conversations when we had this, Doctor, the definition of Islamophobia. The reason why we're still talking about it is in itself Islamophobic. The reason why we haven't adopted it is in itself Islamophobic. But I do think the fact that we are talking about it is better than we weren't talking about it, which is what was under the last government. I will say that. So yes, there is Islamophobia, and it is very mainstream, and there is a conversation that people have to manage with the far right and with the hard right and in politics sphere. So that's a simple answer, really. Yeah. In terms of coming back to your question about how do we, and that ties into this question here, about how do we get communities? When we disagree, we can disagree agreeably. And the question is then, if I'm saying this is my agency or my daughter's agency of choosing to wear the hijab, it might be disagreeable, but it's okay to disagree. That's the thing. It's where do we get to that disagreeability in that context without overriding people? And one of the examples somebody said to me recently was the vegan example. You know, we don't go into a vegan restaurant and expect them to serve any meat, do we? But do we then challenge their ideology of why they're vegan? Well, what is it? Which principles drive them? You know, I'm a meat eater. I can't ever imagine not being a meat eater because I like meat. But what I'm saying is, do we question it? Do we question when somebody's not drinking alcohol because they're, you know, and they're having a shandy because they're having a teetotal or Movember? But when it comes to Muslims, there's a different yardstick. So I want to leave that thought with you, that how much do we question Muslims and expect Muslims to be like what fits in with our narrative rather than allow them to be?
My solution is I just don't go to vegan restaurants. Last question, if you will. I'm sorry, we're like really on a hard deadline, but go ahead. And McDonald, maybe you might want to, or whomever you're addressing.
It wasn't so much a question as a comment about this, but you completely answered it. It's just that from my point of view, it's actually anti-feminist to assume that women who wear hijab are not choosing it, that they couldn't possibly be choosing it. And I think it's the biggest failing of the left. I have so many friends who are left-wing and they are so right on everything to the nth degree, but they will not hesitate to say that Islam is bad for women. And I have these endless discussions of saying, no. Why your very ground of assumption is that Islamic women can't possibly choose anything because they're Muslims, and you're caught in this wheel of like, because they're Muslims, they can't be choosing. And so then we have to free them and we have to. And also, I'm alarmed because I'm not a Muslim, I've read loads about it. I think it's amazing. When I came to Bradford, I read lots and I was just blown away. What an amazing religion. But when I go to India, people don't hesitate. And here, my Western friends, my Hindu friends, people I just meet on the street don't hesitate to say, oh, Britain's being taken over by Muslims now. And it's not a comforting, I'm alarmed. It's like the acceptable face of prejudice. And I think it needs to be educated about big time, really quickly. But I also think situations like this where we get to talk and you get to ask questions and we get to open up are really important, fast.
And thank you for that validation. Thank you for that. McDonald, I'm going to allow you 30 seconds just because you haven't spoken and because Salman excluded the Australian and the American from his question to really... Yeah, right. Go for it.
My only maybe parting thought is, look, there's been a failure of politics over decades now. I mean, if you think about austerity, if you think about what's happening more recently, there's been a failure of politics. The problem is that the blame is not with the politicians. The blame is being on the migrant communities, on Muslims, on others. And this is what's happened, that the people in power who have failed us, failed white working class communities, failed the most vulnerable in society, they're the people who should be held to account for their failures. But what are they doing? Look here, look at these Muslims out there who are eating their halal meat. Oh my God. That's what there is. It's a distraction. It's dangerous. And unfortunately, there is this big push to try and demonize this minority community. And I think it's very dangerous. And I agree that we're in a precipice, and we need to make sure that our politicians do a lot better.
I just have one last one. I know there was a gentleman who asked a question which we didn't answer earlier on. I don't know if he's still here or not, but just on that issue to wrap up, this obsession with demonizing minorities and yet wanting to celebrate just the fun part comes down to this trope I learned early on in my career, which is Western nations want the culture of the people but not the people of the culture. And I think for Muslims, that couldn't be truer. They want our fun, they want our food, but they don't want our humanity. So I think forums like this and politicians that we get on side, absolutely essential.
All right, to be continued. Thank you, Tasneem Chopra. Thank you, Mikdad Versi. Thank you, Naz Shah. And thank you for really adding to the vibrancy of this panel.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.